Welcome back. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1968, students at San Francisco State staged the longest campus strike in U.S. history, demanding the establishment of ethnic studies and an environment of equal opportunity for higher education. 5 months and hundreds of arrests later, the first ever College of Ethnic Studies was born. Protests have taken on a different form today. Hundreds of ethnic studies programs have been created since SF State's landmark action, but many in California face budget cuts and department consolidations. Last spring, UC Berkeley students staged a hunger strike to protest the cuts to their ethnic studies department. Earlier this month at City College of San Francisco, hundreds of people rallied in support of diversity studies, which encompasses women's studies, interdisciplinary studies, labor and community studies, and LGBT studies. The Board of Trustees voted last month to eliminate many of the department chairs and consolidate their departments as a cost-cutting measure. So today we'll talk about bringing diversity into higher education. How do you do it? How do you know when it's not working? We'll look back at the history of ethnic studies also, and we'll try to make sense of the battles that are going on today, and we'll answer the question, what does ethnic studies really mean? And diversity studies, what do they really mean? What place have they held historically, and what are they doing today, and what has been gained by the creation of these departments, and what may be lost in their consolidation? Joining us today is Kenneth Montero. He's the Dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State. He's a cognitive psychologist focusing on the social and cultural influences of learning and health, particularly in the African American and LGBTQ communities. He joins us here in studio. Hi, Professor Montero.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And also with us is Ardell Thomas. She's chair of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies Department at City College in San Francisco. She earned her doctorate in modern thought and literature at Stanford University. And she joins us now in studio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you for being here, professors. And from this point on, I'll call you Kenneth and Ardell as you asked. So let's start off by talking about kind of this question: what is ethnic studies? And Professor Montero, what was the beginning of ethnic studies like at San Francisco State?
Yeah, the beginning of ethnic studies at San Francisco State is actually the core of the beginning of the modern ethnic studies movement. The Black Student Union then joins with a coalition called the Third World Liberation Front, which is a set of a multi-ethnic group, and that also joins with progressive white students, then with labor, and they make three demands. They make actually a dozen and a half demands, but I'm going to summarize them into three. We want access. We want a variety of folks in. Two, we want a different academic climate. That tends to be like the TRIO EOP programs. In other words, changing how the institution treats the intellectual climate so that students of different ethnicities, genders, were more comfortable. And third, we want to change the intellectual content of the university. The university now needs to be relevant to the education of all peoples coming and to do it from the voices and the intellectual traditions of all the people coming. So that's where we leverage into ethnic studies. Ethnic studies then becomes a place where the intellectual traditions and the way it was born at San Francisco State, where African Americans, Asian Americans, American Indians, and Latino, it was called RASA at the time, RASA studies. And those four departments were not to represent the whole universe of ideas, but a huge universe that the university had not covered. And so you now infuse the intellectual traditions in the intellectual traditions, and the intellectual traditions of all people always talk about how one has liberated and lifted oneself up, how one has served oneself, how one has developed a society. And so ethnic studies also does that. So it talks about the liberation struggles and therefore, and it's related, and we'll probably in the conversation talk about, related to the upward movement of gender studies, what becomes LGBTQ in studies, what becomes disability studies, and where people are gaining our own voice to tell our own stories. It's no longer the study of us, it's a study by us.
Mm-hmm. And so curriculum, I imagine, would have been an issue at that time. You're starting these new programs. You're starting to study about all these different cultures that are within the community. When curriculum was discussed, what happened? How did we come to the curriculum that we have today?
What was exciting, it was actually real academics at work. Most of the time people think about academics as going to a classroom and having someone pour information into your head. That is a tool. It's training. It's a part of what we do. So it's nothing wrong with that. But real academics are a set of folks coming together, doing their research, and either discovering or rediscovering knowledge, resharing it, reshaping it, reanalyzing it. So the universities, most of the people in the universities didn't have any training in any of these ideas. You had a set of folks who had on their own been training themselves, and you had a set of folks who were willing to retrain themselves and go back into libraries, archives, do the oral histories or do these studies. And they then wrote curriculum together. Students, community members, and the small number of faculty on campus who were committed to this wrote the new curriculum. And that sounds so strange because most of us don't get to see academics born. You don't get to see the academic area being birthed. That's how it was born. People don't picture Harvard when it was one professor and 12 students. Mm-hmm. They don't picture the Sorbonne that way, when it was just one or two professors, a little building, and a few students. That's what we got to see. We got to see the birth of an academic area, and other areas had similar kinds of things. So it was an exciting moment. I had to view it from afar because I had to read it in the newspapers. I wasn't there at San Francisco State, but I've come to know and have great friends over the last several decades who were actually there and got to shape ethnic studies at San Francisco State.
Ardell, can you talk a little bit about kind of your own journey from student to professor? What were some of the classes that impacted you?
I was very fortunate. I got my bachelor's at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and I was there during the 1980s. It was a very political time in Boulder. And Michelle Baralli, who is a lecturer in women's studies, taught a class called Women Identified Women Writers. It had to be called that. That was code for lesbian literature. And she really brought the community together. She also demanded that we not just look at what we think of as lesbian literature. She did a lot of queer theory before it was called queer theory. And it's interesting that at the time, I'm not sure if the University of Colorado fully appreciated Michelle. Amherst College, however, saw a pioneer and swooped her up, and she's been at Amherst for the past nearly 30 years. But that's where the door opened for me, is within that women's studies program. I also took a lot of ethnic studies within women's studies and queer ethnic studies, even though it certainly wasn't called that at the time. So for me, I was already on an early trajectory. I was also very political. I came out when I was 19 at CU, and I did a lot of protests. I was at the 1987 March on Washington for LGBT rights. It was actually called lesbian and gay rights at that point. The alphabet soup hadn't gotten as big as it is. But in 1987, we had just had Bowers versus Hardwick go through the Supreme Court to uphold the sodomy laws in the United States. We had hundreds of people at that march dying from AIDS, many of whom didn't make it back home. It's the first time the AIDS Memorial quilt was unveiled. And it was there in that crowd of, you know, depending on which newspaper you read, it was at least 500 to 800,000 people, including Jesse Jackson was one of the main speakers at the march. That weekend changed my life. I'd finished my bachelor's. I was getting ready to start a master's, and I realized I can't be in the closet. I'm in everyday interactions. I can't do it. Because one of the luxuries often of being LGBT is you can make that choice. And very often, if you're a person of color, say, you don't get to make that choice. You know, depending on gender identity, you might not get to make that choice of passing or not. And so for me, that was a pivotal moment. And, you know, throughout my master's, I did queer theory. I had a couple of professors who were actually straight allies at the University of Colorado, where I got my master's in English literature. Kelly Hurley, in particular, who is still there and still a dear friend. encouraged me, while other classmates in my master's program made fun of me. You know, they thought it was ridiculous. What's this queer studies stuff? And then I got into Stanford. And the interdisciplinary program at Stanford, it's just a very different ball game where people respected what I was doing. Mm. And my study has always been the intersections of race and sexuality, specifically in 19th century British, had been my main focus, post-colonial studies and queer studies. Mm-hmm. So
that's Ardell Thomas. She's the chair of, now chair, of the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies Department at City College in San Francisco. City College is in the news prominently these days for the Ethnic Studies Department consolidation or possible consolidation. So let's kind of jump into that. What led to that, Ardell?
At City College?
At City College.
The bottom line is it's one of the ways City College is looking to save money is they're looking to all of the small departments. Mm. So it's actually not just the departments that are being looked at, specifically the Diversity Collaborative, Asian Studies, Asian American Studies, Latin American, Latino Studies, African American Studies, Philippine Studies, Interdisciplinary Studies, Labor and Community Studies, Women's
That's
studies and
range.
LGBT studies. Yes, mm-hmm. It's a huge range, but we all looked at each other when we heard they were going to start to consolidate, and we saw the powers that be were going to go for what looked, quote unquote, looked to them like a natural fit. Oh, here, let's just throw all the people of color studies over here and call it ethnic studies. And, oh, queers and women, well, y'all are kind of doing gender stuff. Let's throw you over here. And actually, at this point, it's been very empowering because we have all gotten together, all the chairs of all of those departments, and said, no, 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 wait a minute. We are all going together, if anything. We are not going to let you fracture us. That African American studies is also queer studies, and queer studies is also African American studies. And we have new curriculum being developed, and we have a course that's been taught now for two semesters, Latin American, Latino studies, LGBT studies. It's split between both departments, and it's looking specifically at the Latino LGBT experience. Students, as Ken said, this has been very exciting. Students have helped inform our curriculum. We have a new transgender class that I'm teaching that has just gone through. And it actually focuses predominantly on transgender people of color because those are the students we're serving in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that... So right now what we're battling is, one, we want to keep our departments separate. It's very important that we keep our own identities while we work together because if we just mash it all together, we're going to lose specificity. And the specific struggles of Philippine people and Filipino and Filipino people and of Latino people and Latina people are very different. And the struggles of LGBT people, even if they're also from those communities.
So I want to ask you about
layers
it. Yeah, what will be lost and what will it look like if this happens? But first, let me let our listeners know that we would love you to call in and be a part of our conversation. The number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. How has diversity played a part in your education? When you were in college, what did you take any ethnic studies courses? Did you take any diversity courses? What did they do for you in life? Who did you interact with? What was missing in your education? And what changed the way you interact with your community today? If you're a student, how does diversity play a part in your education, if at all? And if you're a CCSF student and you're listening to us, we want to know what you think of the consolidation of the Ethnic Studies Department. If you're a San Francisco State student, we have your Dean of Ethnic Studies here, Professor Kenneth Montero. Give us a call. Tell us about your experiences. 866-798-TALK, or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ardell Thomas, what really looks like what's going to happen if don't look at me like that, if this consolidation goes through? What is the fear? What will be lost?
if the consolidation goes through and the department chairs, we do get the small departments get one course release to be department chairs. Now,
what does that mean?
That means, well, at City College, we're a community college, so a full teaching load at a community college is 5 classes each semester. That's a lot. So we get one course off to also administer our department. So I teach 4 courses each semester. What this means is if they consolidate and I'm no longer a department chair, I don't mind a 5th class. That's not the problem here. I will revert back into the classroom. All of the department chairs will. But what it means is we will knock out a part-time faculty. And in our smaller departments, part-time faculty are a huge part of how we remain diverse. Because the tiny departments, you know.
Like what? What are the tiny departments?
Well, the all of the ones in our diversity collaborative. Also, there are other programs being involved here. Disability studies at City College is another one, and geography. But, yeah, interestingly, and speech and communications. But if we have to go back to the class, that's going to bump out, because they're not going to give us more classes. They're not going to just give me an extra class to cut the budget. I'm going to then go in and have to take over one of my part-timer's classes, which means my part-timer won't have that job. Mm. So the person, for instance, who teaches, I'm not saying that this is what would happen, but the person who teaches our Queer People of Color class, if this happened, she could get bumped. Or the person who teaches our cinema class, she could get bumped. Or the person who teaches our Latin American, Latino studies, LGBT class, he could get bumped.
And we don't know who's getting bumped if this consolidation happens.
That's right. And so if I go back into that classroom because chairs, we would have to go in and take that class. And then part-timers go. That's also one of the ways our faculty, I mean, we have 5 faculty in LGBT studies. And out of 5 faculty, 2 are people of color. And 1 is a senior citizen. I mean, we have some different interesting sorts of diversity just with 5 of us. I mean, we need to be more diverse. Mm. But this is also going to undo some of that diversity, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
If the white chick, me, for those of you who can't see me, goes back into the classroom, we've just lost some form of diversity.
That's Ardell Thomas. And Professor Kenneth Montero, let me ask you kind of, what other roles do ethnic studies play? In addition to students are coming in and studying about various cultures, various struggles, what else do these classes do? For example, our producer was talking about these classes being a safe space for people mm-hmm. of certain cultures or of certain background. Yeah. What else do these classes do that might be missed if for example, consolidation happens.
I'd like to answer that as a two-part question. I'll
sure.
put together the question you asked and also get back to what consolidation does academically and what it doesn't do that people think it does administratively, because the administrator in me has had a couple of decades of that. First of all, if all it did was exposed people to a broader range of, remember what we're talking about, the intellectual, cultural contributions of a greater portion of the world, a portion of the world that demographically is the majority of the world. So let's put that in context. So if it only did that, it would be doing a whole bunch, and that's what it's already doing. The creating a safe space, people need to think about this. Why do universities have non-safe spaces around sexuality, gender, race, ethnicity, national origin, language from your family home? Well, the creating of a safe space for intellectual achievement is extremely important. Part of having a liberal education, that doesn't mean leftist, it means the education that free people need. That's what it means, is to create spaces where people can think creatively, not just regurgitate facts given to them to serve somebody else. So if it just did that, that would be wonderful. We just had a study at San Francisco State. We're large enough, so we have a kind of where they did a study of the top criteria for what it means to be educated in liberal education. So this is the American Association of University Professors puts out these criteria. They've created a questionnaire on campus to do this. Of the 20 questions, of 13 of them, those who went through the College of Ethnic Studies reported getting more of what it meant to have a liberal education than the other colleges. Remember what the questionnaire was about. It was not about ethnic studies. It was about, are you getting the kind of education that you're supposed to be getting as a broadly educated human being who's going out to serve society? 13 of the 20 questions, people coming through the College of Ethnic Studies. So the thing about the university creating the educated, well-prepared student, mm-hmm. just in a general sense, our students are saying they're getting it. It also helps to move a society. We keep saying, let's use this word diversity.
Right.
Which I have comfort with and problems with. When you say diversity just in the English language, you just mean variation. So diversity studies, and we're going to talk about this, diversity studies really doesn't mean diversity studies, because diversity studies means the university. The study of all humanity and its contributions is everything you can fit into the university. So the English department is part of diversity studies in that sense. What we mean is it's a euphemism for the studies of those who have usually been taken out of it. And that's what we have in common. Now, it happens because we've worked in coalition. We found the other human connections that we have, and so we've created these studies at the crossroads. So we add another facet, that we get out of our silos, and we show not only our uniquenesses as human beings, but we show where we really do overlap without disrespecting the uniqueness. So we don't have to be a mush. We don't have to be everything is everything. But on the other hand, within our uniqueness, we find our common ground. So, we don't force it on each other. So
do you have a problem then with putting all of these studies under the umbrella of diversity studies?
The problem I have is the same problem I would have as an academic of putting physics and religious studies together. Mm. A physicist would die hearing that. Plus or minus one or two physicists. Not because they've never been together. Under the Holy Roman Empire, the physicist and the priest were the same person. Then there was the Scientific Revolution. I'm older than you in the room, but I wasn't there then. But I've read about it, and what was exciting about the Scientific Revolution was you had a way of thinking that wanted to be relevant to a set of people who wanted to think a different way. And the revolution was ended by a theoretical treaty by Descartes, where he said, we won't challenge you too much in the church if you'll just let us do this dirty business of science. That literally kept the heads of scientists. They would have been killed. If you look at the 1960s, many ethnic studies, women's studies, queer studies folks literally lost their head. Harvey Milk lost his life. This is not theory here. So you've got these things that are very, very important. So you need these places where we can, partly for identity, partly for safe spaces. This is all good. Educational environment should have it. Every educator throughout, safe spaces are important for creativity. But it's also about having an intellectual center of gravity. You need people who have similar expertise, talking, acting, analyzing, writing, painting, constructing new technologies and innovating near each other. And you also need them to get out of it. So I loved how Adele spoke about there's already a coalition. There's already a diversity coalition. But they need their departments to do their deep work. And then there's a practical inclusion. The last thing I wanted to say about that is when you're making administrative decisions, and I say this, and I'm not saying this about City College, because I'm not there, so the administrators and faculty will hash that out. That's the struggle. To the degree that I can be helpful, we can call as colleagues, we can do that sort of thing. But another thing about organizing and liberation movements, you don't liberate anyone else. Okay?
That's Professor Kenneth Montero.
But it's mission and money.
Mission and money. We're going to have to take a break, Professor Kenneth Montero, and with me is Ardell Thomas as well. We're going to take a short break. I know we have some callers on the line. Sit tight, and we'll be back after the break.
You're enjoying today's Your Call here on Local Public Radio. To engage in today's conversation, you can just call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's next. Today, we're having a conversation about diversity and ethnic studies in higher education, and we want to take your calls. Please call us at 866-798-TALK to share your experience. What diversity classes did you take? Do you like the term diversity at all? What ethnic studies courses did you take in college, and how have they helped you over the years in your life? And who did you interact with? What was missing, did you feel, in your education that you wish was included? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. With us is Kenneth Montero of San Francisco State's Ethnic Studies Department. He is the Dean of the College of Ethnic Studies. And also Ardell Thomas is the Chair of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies at City College in San Francisco. Kenneth, let's go back. We left off. You said two words. You said mission and money.
Right. I was transitioning from Ardell, and I had been talking about what the various things underneath the rubric of diversity study add to the educational, academic, intellectual, and relevant service to our, using that word, diverse communities. So now I'm not talking, as I said, City College will have its struggle in its own way, but in terms of sitting there as just abstractly as an administrator, the two top things you should think about when you're combining or contracting or changing is the mission of the institution, intellectually, and who you're serving. Does your action advance that? And the other is, under difficult times, money. Does it have a significant impact? And it's not just whether it cuts dollars. It's, does that cut add value? Now, that's always net. What did you gain? What did you lose when you put it together? So if you cut only a nickel, but you lose $100 worth of value, you don't make that cut. Mm-hmm. If you had to cut $100, but you saved $1 million worth of value, then you make that cut because you can move that value around. In the diversity studies pieces, I get the interactions and the collaborations because we've always done that. Sometimes not as much as we'd like to, but we've always liked to. We get that. But collapsing the departments, and I don't know your budgets, but I'm just going to say, based on knowing the budgets of ethnic studies and women's studies programs around the nation.
Ardell said zero. She had her hand in a zero.
We don't get anything.
You can't solve an administrative cold with the amount of money in these departments. Mm. They're usually the smallest. I think most of you either have no staff
at City College.
Yes. This is my recollection, but no staff, or a chair gets one course off. If you took away, you made them all go back and do their one courses, and you took away their no staff, and so the amount of money you're going to save, I don't want to say this because we might get a call, but we could almost give them that amount of money right now.
Yes.
So let's go to some calls, actually. We have a number of people on the line who want to get in on this. So let's go first to Leela in San Francisco. Hi, Leela.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I went to school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I just feel that the fact that we have so many diverse classes offered to us, it really contributed to a more focused direction for me after college. And I think that offering more diverse courses propelled me in a different direction. So I started focusing on the African diaspora. I ended up learning Spanish as a second language. And I think it was all because we have these very broad offerings at our university, and I just think it's a step backward to start rearranging these courses in this way and pulling them back. So I'm just really hoping it doesn't go in that direction.
Okay, thank you for your call. Will there be courses that will be lost then, Ardell? Like she's saying, I really don't want to see a world where these courses, there are no ethnic studies courses, or some of them are lost. Will they be lost if this consolidation happens? Or
In LGBT studies, yes. In all of our smaller departments, yes. Because I, for instance, I have an interdisciplinary PhD, but my broadest range is within humanities and kind of softer social sciences. Some of the more behavioral science-focused courses are harder social science classes. I cannot teach those. So when I go back into the classroom and bump somebody, we could lose one of those classes. We could lose one of those classes that I constantly get the emails about that people said, queer people of color, that class taught by Trinity Ordona changed my life, you know. Or Eddie Kaufman's gay male relationships. I mean, I can't teach that. And yes, we actually would. I mean, the course wouldn't disappear out of the catalog, but we would be stuck in a position until later if things get better when I could hire somebody again. But at the moment, yes, there's no way we won't lose something.
Thank you for that call, Leela. Let's go to another caller because we have a couple of them. Let's go to Lark in San Francisco. Hi, Lark.
Hi, thanks. I love KLW. I've been listening my whole life.
Thank you for listening.
Speaking of diversity, KLW has, I think, the most diverse programming, so thank you. And I did turn on the show late, so I'm a little sorry, but just a couple comments. One, the gentleman who was speaking, I especially loved the part he said about how it's kind of penny-wise, pound-foolish. The money that you'll be saving is nil. Wanted to just mention that. And as far as City College cutbacks in general, it's horrific. A friend of mine who's a printmaker, and that's how she makes her living. Apparently, they might be cutting out the printmaking program, and she can hardly set up printmaking things in her house. Anyway, it's all of the City College programming cuts are horrible. And as far as the diversity thing, I just wanted to make it. I don't know if it's related directly, but I'm always surprised. I don't know if I'm surprised or not at this point, but as I go around the city, it seems that, although without a doubt, yes, this programming is essential in colleges, it doesn't seem to spill out into the world in general. So as I go around the city, and I have to say it seems worse in San Francisco, when I go to New York and friends of mine from New York comment on it, that things seem really segregated here. Like you have, like, wherever you go, you know, whether it's Bayview, whether it's Mission or here or there, you know, your place is, everyone here is, and it's really limited, like 20 to 22-year-old white people, and here white hipster people, and here it's 30 to 32-year-old gay black people. Or, I mean, I'm kind of being silly a little bit, but not really that much. Things seem really, really, really segregated.
So, anyway, Lark, do you feel then that if kind of if all these people took ethnic studies or diversity studies, not studying only their own heritage but other people's heritage,
that their
lives. Is that what you're saying?
I don't feel that's the simple answer. I don't know what the answer is, but it seemed kind of like a comment that fit in with your show. I don't know what it is. I know in my workplace I see it just in my workplace, people mm-hmm. just kind of go off into their little, I mean, I've heard all kinds of social commentary over my life as to why, that people are more comfortable with someone who, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know, but it seemed to fit into what you're saying. No, I don't think, unfortunately, that's the answer. I think it's maybe a piece of the whole, but
okay.
Anyway, thank you so much for your show.
Thank you, Lark, and thank you for loving KALW. Ardell, would you like to take that on? She says, with all, you know, we are the most diverse city in the most diverse state in the United States, a diverse country. She doesn't see it in the streets. She sees still people are, you know, walking around and being with their own kind.
Well, my immediate comment is, all of those folks that she's seeing out there, quick, get over to City College and San Francisco State and take some of our classes. Actually, in my LGBT classes, the combination of peoples, I always ask, what neighborhoods are people from? I get a mix, you know, East Bay, Bayview, Mission. The Tenderloin is a huge mm-hmm. group of my community in the classroom. And I would actually say that, you know, everybody goes then back to their neighborhoods, perhaps. But at least within our classrooms, the whole city and every part of the city is in my classrooms. It's sometimes uncomfortable. We talk to one another, though, and we build coalitions in the class through education. So perhaps she's just identified a whole bunch of people who still need to come on over to City College and take some of our classes.
Kenneth, I'd like to ask you a question that I was thinking about earlier. I know many people who took ethnic studies, but the people I know, at least some of them, ended up taking their ethnic background study to understand more about themselves, to understand about their history. Rather than I'm African American, I want to take Asian American studies to understand that culture and their background and their struggles. But isn't that one of the missions of ethnic studies as well, not to just understand yourself and where you're from, but to reach out and understand your brother or your sister in humanity, to better relate to them, to treat each other better?
Yeah, it's yes. Education is for both things. It's to learn about self, because all knowledge starts with self-knowledge, quite frankly. Even though, from a Western perspective, we try to act like it doesn't. We somehow live, we think that people live in some godly space and they observe the rest of the universe from that space. But, and it may be true, and I've even taught it in my Western training, that one could take that perspective if one thought they could. But, so both of those are true, but we forget. The college education is about the major and general education. So, and your major is actually smaller than your general education. And for anyone who is, when I say non-white, I actually mean Anglo-Saxon. I mean English-Germanic, comes to New England and the North and the other colonies along the coast. I don't mean the ones from the Louisiana Purchase, and I don't mean the ones from the colony that, even the colonial people. I don't mean the Spanish folks from the colony that we actually happen to have grown up in. When people think of, quote, general education, the general America, it's an America that doesn't even include California. They think they came from pilgrims. The pilgrims never landed in California. I mean, so even whiteness is constructed. So yes, it's about self and it's about other. It happens that an ethnic studies student can't avoid learning about white culture. Not necessarily about everybody else, but about white culture. An ethnic studies student,
because of school as well.
Well, because K through 12, right, that's what you learned.
Right.
So when you get to college, fundamental, even children's literature in your own culture is not familiar to you. And people will even have the nerve to tease you that you don't know it, despite the fact that the school made sure you didn't. So that someone would take ethnic studies in their own culture does not, that means at least they're bicultural in their education, because they would have had to have taken the Anglo-Saxon culture. You have to have. You, on the other hand, could go through and take only Anglo-Saxon culture with a couple of courses, not, I mean, that's sort of like putting a little bit of spice in a soup. It doesn't really change the soup. So it's interesting, people look at that. They don't look, because one of the privileges of, and I'm trained in white psychology. I am. My colleagues might be offended because they might think I'm saying that as a derogatory, because white people normally don't get called white. They don't have to be. That's called people. You know, and so it's, why are you calling me a white people? Because I'm a people and you're a black person, but I'm a person. And you don't think about it until somebody mentions it. When somebody mentions it, you get upset and uncomfortable. And so I am, don't wake up and try this on your own. I am not a white person, but I am a professional in white psychology. I then became a professional in black and African American psychology.
You made a point to.
Mm-hmm. So I at least have the two. Then I started reading about Latinos and whatever. So part of the mythology in America is that there is this broad education that people of color and lesbians, gays, women aren't getting. No way we cannot get it. So when we go into these other diversity studies, we're somehow segregating ourselves. Can't do it. We live in donuts in this larger society. It's the reverse that happens. So when a caller called about the segregation, actually I find San Francisco very much like Boston or New York. There are ethnic enclaves. There are these boundary areas, and then there's areas that are mushmashes. Mm. And depending on whether you're, for example, I find it easy to find it in San Francisco because I lived here for 25 years. I find it easy to find it in Boston, even though Boston is actually whiter than San Francisco is.
Whiter.
And in New York, I can find it. But if I didn't live there, I've never gone there and I didn't know them, You wouldn't see it. When I fly, one of the things I notice is, because class is part of it, it's associated with race and culture. Doesn't even matter if I fly into Washington, D.C., a majority non-white city. Hmm. The majority of the plane is white. Now, is it because only white people like to hang out in planes? And I'm not being facetious about the individual. The individual actually called out something that's very important. Parts of cities are still extremely segregated. Parts of cities aren't. And part of understanding ethnic studies is to understand that it's not random. So if you wanted to break down those barriers, you couldn't. Don't follow the trend. If you follow the trend, you'll stay in the same ethnic grooves. Mm. To get out of it, you need to grab the hand of someone who gets out of there and find the side streets. And they're side streets to you. They're main streets to someone else.
Mm.
And so I really encourage this person. That person sounds really like an interesting person, and I'm encouraging other people to befriend that person.
All right.
That person, you know.
We have a number of more callers, so let's go to Reza from San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi, Reza.
How are you guys doing? I'm enjoying the conversation so far, particularly because I was a four-year City College student. I barely made it through high school. I ended up at City College. I transferred to UC Riverside, where I actually majored in ethnic studies. And one thing that I wanted to bring up is that the department where I studied at, they were all mostly people of color themselves, and they were also really adamant about kind of exposing the truth behind the whole system that they actually represented. I mean, that's one thing I don't think I've heard the professors on your show discuss, is that many of these universities are actually have their racist institutions at the time of their inception, and it only took social struggle by groups of color and women and quote-unquote minorities to make these changes. And one of the main focuses on ethnic studies, from my perspective, is learning the truth behind the racist institutions of American society and also the European society, how we're still caught up in many of the same struggles that we faced during colonization. Mm-hmm. And I hear people talking about, like, how San Francisco is so diverse and all this type of stuff, and it's been known for the diversity, but actually I'm born and raised in San Francisco, and right now we're facing so much gentrification, mm-hmm. and so much outmoving. I mean, the black population is less than 4% right now. So how diverse are we really? And I feel like ethnic studies is a necessary tool that people need to utilize to be able to understand these types of things as they happen and understand more about themselves and also the other people in their community. I have a friend right now who studies in the master's program at San Francisco State, and she says she's just fed up with all the racism she faces, all the sexism she faces. She says it's not a diverse population there, and I feel like ethnic studies is a huge tool to overcoming some of those challenges.
Okay, thank you so much for the call, Reza. Professor Kenneth, I'm going to play devil's advocate and piggyback off his eloquent bit of talk there. If we've had ethnic studies at San Francisco State since 1968, mm-hmm. why are we so segregated socially? And all these callers are coming up saying we are as segregated as ever. How did diversity play its role then? What's wrong with it? What's happening?
Okay. Just the way you frame the question is wonderful, because what it says is, why does racism still occur? I'm going to translate it in a way,
sure.
way that you understand. Why does racism still occur if small enclaves of people of color have been able to educate a few people? In other words, why did racist America?
Well, now that you say it that way.
I know, exactly. But your framing of your question was actually perfect. It's the way most people would ask the question, the way I would ask the question, if I'm off the top of my head, and then my students would look at me like I was crazy. Because remember, I'm an administrator, I come to different places. So basically, ethnic studies, just to give you a sense of it, ethnic studies just blew up in terms of popularity between the 60s, 70s, peaked in the 80s, and you probably only have half as many ethnic studies departments as you did in the 80s. There was a backlash. There was a backlash against public education, a liberating movement for giving education to the masses, a backlash against all the things you're calling diversity studies. And what this caller, which lets me know he really did take ethnic studies, when I just breezed over the notion of it comes out of the struggles of people of color and progressive whites who saw that the mythologies and the structures in education were about oppression. So, we're teaching in the belly of the beast. So I'm glad that he brought us back to that part. And that's part of where the backlash comes, because there are people who want government to control the minds of people. Free up your money so they can make it, but control your minds. In ethnic studies and women's studies and queer studies, we're talking about power and shifting power. When you say, I'm going to teach myself, control my identity, and serve my community, you have just said you are in a struggle with a society that says your community will not get equitable services. It will not be served. And no, we don't want you to have power, because if you had power, the America, think about the last year's campaign. They're going to take our country away from us. That sentence is rich. I could teach a course or two or a graduate seminar because of what this caller called in about the power under that. They, another American is another, are going to take I who own everything here and all the people in it, from me. Unpackaging that is seen as dangerous. And it is dangerous to anyone who wants to oppress you. But it is liberating and wonderful to the 99% of the people, including the white people who are oppressed. And if you look at the 60s, the most scary moment for the system was the Poor People's March on Washington, because people of color and people who were oppressed for other reasons came together and said, we will stare down power for power, and we're going to take back the power. Not we're going to ask for it, because power doesn't come back that way. You say, no, you've appropriated my power. I don't need power over you. I just need my power back. And you take it back. So when he talks about that, so why is racism still here? When people talk about segregation still here, and I know people say it's as bad as it always has been. It is not as bad as it's always been. I've been, and this was in the 80s, I've been passed over in restaurants in San Francisco.
In the 80s.
In the straight and the queer communities because of color.
And I must say, I'm looking at you right now, and
I'm called High Yellow. I get it.
You're pretty light-skinned.
I knew you were going to be polite about it, so I threw it out the other way so that we can get through. And I get that. And sometimes that produces privilege for me. There is color privilege associated with it. Sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes it goes back to the old-fashioned white, non-white, or black, which is, it doesn't matter. One drop. In fact, if I were blonde, but somebody found out I had a great-great-grandmother who was black, that might make you throw that someplace.
So we only have a couple of minutes, but we really want to get in a final last caller who is an anonymous caller. So go ahead. Hello?
Hi. I wanted to go back to something that Professor Montero said, both about the safe spaces and also the euphemism that diversity has become, because I think that the two are really related. And I'm actually speaking from a personal experience of extreme bullying that comes out of Berkeley, which in many people's imagination is supposedly this very progressive and diverse and liberal space. But, you know, in many ways, it's not. And, I was in a traditional department, not in an ethnic studies department, but trying to speak up about these issues of structural inequality, and was really viciously bullied by other grad students with the support of professors in a department that has no underrepresented minority faculty. And, I think that if one looks at a recent article that came out of the American Anthropologist called Anthropology as White Public Space, you start to understand why it's really important not to use the diversity euphemism and really to talk about structural inequality. And so maybe we should be talking about inequality studies instead, because, you know, much of what's happening is the normalization of some people not being allowed to speak and or speaking for others. And, often diversity is about tokenism. It's about, having one person of this color or one person of this sexual orientation, but not about challenging the power relations, which allow, some people to speak more freely or some people not to speak at all, or for there to really be, equal power relations in the university as well as outside of the university.
And this was at Berkeley, right?
And this was at Berkeley. Mm.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call. We only have about a minute left. Ardell, would you like to speak to that? And also, if you'd like to just go into what's next at City College very briefly. You were shaking your head when she was talking.
Well, this is more personal. I live in Berkeley, and my family's transracial. And I'm white. I probably said that earlier. I think I referred to myself as a white chick. But my family is a transracial family, and I don't want to say I'm surprised because I'm not, but I'm dismayed at, you know, Berkeley is certainly not as radical as one would hope. And it's been a struggle, and I've just had so much stuff said to me and my son in public that is just shocking. I guess I shouldn't be shocked. So
it's seen as the bastion of liberalism, and
it's the bastion of white liberalism in a very particular way. At City College, you were asking what was
what's next now. What are you going to do?
The department chairs are awaiting. The chancellor has finally summoned the department chairs next Friday to a meeting. And I think we are awaiting our fate at that point. I do know that our diversity collaborative, all of our departments are still actively and constantly working together. And I'm sure we'll have more political actions. So look out for that.
Okay. Thank you so much. That is our Del Thomas from CCSF. With us also was Kenneth Montero from San Francisco State. Thank you both for an amazing conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you, the listeners who called in and whoever emailed us as well. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll look at coverage of the clash between corporations and workers, from strikes against Walmart and McDonald's to the supposed demise of the Twinkie. We'll also talk about the power grab by Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and how the New York Times and others got it wrong in reports saying Morsi had backed down. Where did you find great reporting this week? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.